As Americans finish voting in Tuesday's midterms, how are Ukrainians viewing the election?
Ukrainians are quite positive about a future military support and humanitarian support that the U.S. is providing.
Plus, what's the economic and industrial outlook for European countries as they prepare for winter months without Russian gas?
In terms, generally speaking, high energy prices have hurt economic growth in a sense that they reduced consumer spending, consumer purchasing powers, so there's a lower demand on goods.
And later in the program, we share the story of some rescued lions, and we'll find out what keeps an ambassador up at night. Today is Tuesday, November 8th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller.
And I'm Steve Karish. Linda Thomas Greenfield is the United States Ambassador to the United Nations. She's currently in Ukraine, but Monday she was in Tirana, Albania, where she met with Arman Miro of VOA's Albanian service. He began by asking her if she was worried Russia would back out of a UN and Turkey-brokered grain deal between Moscow and Kyiv.
That grain deal has been an important contributor to really dealing with some of the currents in the food security environment. Russia and Ukraine provide significant amounts of grain. More than 10 million metric tons of grain have gone through this quarter since this deal started. So this is an important, important accomplishment for the international community. Particularly, I want to commend the Secretary General for the extraordinary effort that he and his team made working with Turkey to forge this deal with Russia and Ukraine. The very temporary announcement by Russia of pulling out of the deal last week caused lots of friction in the market. So our hope is that this will be extended. This grain deal is important to the global south, it's important to Ukraine, and it's also important to Russia.
Next, Miro brought up the midterm elections and the idea that Republicans might cut support for Ukraine if they gain power.
Look, I'm not going to comment on domestic politics, but what I will say is that the support for Ukraine has been bipartisan, and the president will work with whatever Congress there is to ensure that we continue our commitment to the Ukrainian people.
How does the ambassador see the fact that Iran is supplying Russia with drones, which are being used in Ukraine?
The Iranian foreign minister admitted that they are providing these drones. They implied that they were only provided at the beginning of this and that they weren't armed. The truth is that Iranian drones have been used to attack civilians in Ukraine, breaking Security Council resolutions that bar such a shipment of arms from Iran and also to Russia. So both countries are accountable for this. It shows that that Russia has to depend on Iran to get their arms, and that Iran is willing to provide arms to a country that has attacked its neighbor, a country that is a permanent member of the Security Council. It's not the kind of behavior that we would expect from Russia. We're not surprised from Iran, but again, this is breaking Security Council resolutions, and it is something that we need to deal with in the Council.
And for his final question, Arman Miro asks Ambassador Thomas Greenfield one of my favorite questions. What keeps her awake at night?
Oh, my goodness. It changes from day to day, but I would say the key thing that keeps me awake is that we have a permanent member of the Security Council who is really compromising and attacking a neighbor, really jeopardizing peace and security and not honoring the position that they have, being a permanent member of the council. The impact that that is having on questioning the confidence of the world in the Security Council, questioning our abilities to deal with this situation. I know that we're dealing with the situation. I know that we're isolating Russia, but I know that this means that we have to really ramp up our own efforts at Security Council reform and at how we address threats to peace and security in the future.
That's Linda Thomas-Greenfield, the United States Ambassador to the United Nations. As Americans head to the polls Tuesday, an increasing number of candidates, particularly Republicans, voice doubt about continuing financial and military support for Ukraine. Anna Chernikova is in Kyiv. Midterm elections are today. Today's election day in the United States. What's the mood in Kyiv and in Ukraine generally about what's going on here?
So if we talk about society, civil society of Ukraine, most of people were actually very positive about any outcome of this election. So people are sure that it doesn't matter which party has more votes and which party has the lead. U.S. will continue to support. They say that it's mostly about U.S. people. The will of U.S. people is basically represented by both parties, and Ukrainians are quite positive about a future military support and humanitarian support that U.S. is providing. So I should say that Ukrainians, well, they basically have this understanding that it doesn't matter which party is leading. It's a long-term relations between U.S. and Ukraine, and this support will continue as it is now.
That's the opinion of the people in general. What about the political classes? What are they thinking?
I was talking to Mr. Davidyuk, political scientist, and he said that he basically supported this kind of reaction by people. He said that it is true that this long-term relation that Ukraine and U.S. already has and will have in the future would continue, and support would continue because of these long-term relations. What he means by that is that basically Ukraine is fighting for the same values that U.S. has, and this war in Ukraine is war for, first of all, for these values and for this and for independence, for freedom, and this is what U.S. Supports very much and cannot stay aside. And he says that despite all this official announcement by some representatives of the Republican Party, he's sure that in general support will continue. I also had a chance to talk to political expert Volodymyr Fesenko, and he said that he has slight concern regarding the speed of support in the future in case some of the members of the Republican Party would be against that. But again, he said that these concerns are not critical. He also supports the idea that it doesn't really matter who will take the lead today, because Ukraine is fighting, first of all, for the values and for the well-being of the region. And this is what U.S. is supporting. So it's not only about money. It's also about, it's very important, about the values.
Anna Chernikova reports for VOA from Kyiv. A new report suggests that Ukraine urgently needs more air defense systems from the West, or Russia could repeat the tactics it used in Syria to bombard Ukrainian cities from the skies. Henry Ridgewell has more from London.
In the early days of Russia's invasion, the skies above Ukraine were largely unprotected. Russian jets conducted air raids deep behind the front lines. But Ukraine was able to deploy its air defenses. Ukrainian forces have shot down dozens of Russian fighter jets, helicopters, other aircraft, and missiles. Justin Bronk is an analyst with the Royal United Services Institute.
The Russian Air Force retains a huge amount of potential firepower. It's just not being able to use it effectively at the moment because Ukraine is still denying them access to Ukrainian airspace above very low level. because they still have these surface-to-air missile systems. But Ukrainian stocks of missiles for air defense were not nearly intended to last this long.
Meanwhile, Russia is using Iranian-made loitering drones and long-range missile strikes to pound Ukraine's cities and infrastructure. Again, Royal United Services Institute's Bronk.
The West really needs to focus on delivering additional ammunition and eventually replacement SAM systems with systems we can more easily support, because, of course, these are Soviet-era systems that we don't use ourselves in the West.
Western nations have supplied various air defense systems. Ukraine's defense minister said on Twitter Monday his country had received the first American NASAMS and Italian-made Aspid systems from the US, Norway and Spain. Defense Minister Alexei Reznikov said the priority number one is air defense systems. Our partners know this very well. Germany sent an Iris-T air defense system last month and is supplying dozens of Gepard anti-aircraft tanks. France has sent its Crotale air defense system. Bronk says Ukraine needs more from the West. Advanced fighter aircraft would also create an important deterrent.
Even a small number of Western fighters equipped with missiles and radars that are able to meet Russian fighters on relatively equal terms.
The likely consequence of Russia gaining control of the skies is tragically evident, says Bronk.
We know what happens in Syria when the Russian Air Force is able to attack with relative impunity from medium and higher altitudes. Large-scale bombardments with a lot of unguided bombs on not just frontline positions, but also besieged cities. We remember Aleppo and Homs.
Those cities were all but destroyed by Russian and Syrian government airstrikes in 2015 and 2016 at the height of the civil war. Tens of thousands of people were killed, forcing a withdrawal of rebel forces. As Russia's ground forces are forced back in eastern Ukraine, analysts fear the Kremlin wants to repeat the tactics used in Syria on Ukrainian cities. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. European countries have been preparing for a potentially cold, harsh winter. They grapple with a reduced supply of Russian hydrocarbons and a concerted effort to reduce their reliance on natural gas supplied by Moscow. Matteo Ilardo is a Europe analyst with RAIN, the risk intelligence company. And I began our conversation by asking him why he believes the current high energy prices and high energy demand will hurt European Union economic growth and industrial competition.
Yeah, so that's the key question, Steve. So in broader terms, generally speaking, high energy prices have hurt economic growth in a sense that they reduced consumer spending, consumer purchasing powers. So there's a lower demand on goods, which is partially also reflected in lower industrial output in certain sectors of European industry more than others. But overall, in general, both services and manufacturing across the board in Europe. And then we have higher input costs for producers that are now having to deal with higher energy bills, and running certain operations has become basically uneconomical. Particularly for energy-intensive sectors, such as steel, glass, ceramics, paper, food, fertilizers, and but also for sectors that use natural gas, not just as a source of power, but also as a feedstock. And we're talking about, for instance, the chemical sector or fertilizers, as I was saying. So clearly, these sectors had to reduce operations or halting them altogether, which is hurting economic growth and has also caused some layoffs to start in the continent. And then if we look a bit beyond just the short term, of course, government actions in supporting businesses and consumers with supports to pay energy bills is helping. But if we look beyond that, we'll see how energy prices are set to remain higher in Europe compared to definitely to compared to what they used to be for the past decade, but also higher compared to other regions such as Asia or particularly such as North America, the United States. So we'll see now on the medium to long term, European prices will be higher and therefore European manufacturers will lose a competitive advantage against their North American or Asian counterparts because they'll have to basically compete on global markets for the same energy source, global LNG, which will be more expensive for Europeans than it will be for Americans, whereas the difference that so far made Europeans operating on cheaper energy than Asians, that Asian producers will disappear because Asians so far had the so-called Asian premium because they had to rely on LNG, whereas Europe was able to rely on cheap Russian gas through pipelines. Long story short, the advantage is gone, and now Europeans will have to compete without that advantage.
I want to talk a little bit more about that because, you know, ever since Russia began its invasion of Ukraine, Europe has been looking at this energy crunch. But during this process, European nations began stockpiling gas reserves, holding on to it in anticipation of a complete shutoff of Russia. There's, you know, this price cap that, you know, countries have been looking to implement. You know, is that going to play an effect? Because you mentioned that the cost burden is now on these companies with these skyrocketing costs.
Yeah, that's actually a very good question. And they did accelerate purchases of gas and through various means, signing new supply deals with some suppliers that could deliver through pipeline, Norway, Azerbaijan, North African countries, especially Algeria, but especially by purchasing LNG on the global market. And to do so, they had to outbid other buyers around the world, particularly in Asia. There's only so much that buyers can actually get on the global market because most of LNG supplies are locked in long-term supply deals. So the remaining quantities that can be bought on the short term then are lower than the actual demand needs, and so they become very expensive. And Europe accelerated this purchasing to replenish in stocks before winter. We saw prices peaking in August exactly because of that. One of the main buyers and therefore one of the main drivers behind such high prices that we saw this summer was also where countries such as Germany, Italy, other European countries basically trying to make sure to meet storage targets by October and then by November, which for the short term, it means that gas rationing or blackouts, so to say, will be less likely, of course, provided that we have an average winter in Europe, not too cold, and we don't have non-Russian supply disruptions, which could occur, for instance, because of climate events.
Now that there has been a reduction on the Nord Stream pipelines, do you see that playing an extra effect on the ability of countries to store more gas in preparation for winter? And then moving forward, you know, as you just said, if countries are using their stockpile this year, you know, what does that mean for next year in greater detail?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I would say that the fact that we had those leaks, as you mentioned, in both Nord Stream pipelines doesn't necessarily affect the supply situation in Europe because both lines were taken offline already before the incidents in September. What it does, though, it definitely takes out of the question whether supplies through the pipelines will come back anytime soon. That's why after the incidents, markets, prices on European energy markets increased because it added on, let's say, nervousness of the markets that supplies won't increase. Russia won't concede on gas supplies through the Nord Stream pipelines. And it also increased fears that further sabotage. Now, we don't know who did that, but it appears clear the actions were sabotage. Probably behind that there was a state actor. So It increased fears that further sabotage could occur to other pipelines or gas infrastructures in Europe, which would eventually actually decrease supplies. So that's definitely something that the market is very worried about and is looking at. But to answer the second part of your question, then we'll have definitely more difficulties next year to trying and rebuilding stocks for the winter after. So we're talking about the winter in 2023-24. And this is why, because normally, after an average winter in Europe, stocks are about 20% full in March when the heating season, let's see, it's called off, when weather starts being warmer across the continent. So that's usually the case in March. We have 20% full. But that usually is the case when throughout winter, Russian gas through pipelines continue to flow into European customers. This is not the case anymore this winter. So to go through winter, Europe will probably have to burn through all its reserves, or most of them.
Teo Ilardo, he's a Europe analyst with Rain, the risk intelligence company, and we'll have more of our conversation on tomorrow's program.
It's not just people and pets that have become victims in the war in Ukraine. In some cases, wild animals have been forced to evacuate as well. Oleski Kovalenko looks at some lions that were rescued from the Odessa Biopark Zoo. Anna Rice narrates the story.
When Russia invaded Ukraine, 10 lions in a small private zoo became unwitting victims of the war in Ukraine. The war ended its funding, and the owners had no way to feed the big cats or keep them warm in winter.
We need some 800 kilos of meat a week. So due to supply chain problems and a lack of funding, we found ourselves in a tough situation.
The nonprofit Warriors of Wildlife stepped in to help. The organization has been helping animals in Ukraine since 2014.
So we said absolutely we would do it, and that's when we started putting the whole plan together, getting all the permits in place, so that we could go in and fetch the lions.
Dalunga says only one place agreed to take the whole pride, the Wild Animal Sanctuary in the U.S. state of Colorado.
When we did get contacted by the zoo in Odessa, they said, no, we'd rather the lions just go to a good permanent home. At that point, we agreed to help rescue the lions.
Wild Animal Sanctuary paid to transport the 9 lions to the U.S. Other expenses were shared between the sanctuary and a number of other animal rights groups, including Animals Australia. The big cats finally arrived at the sanctuary on October 5th.
It's amazing how intelligent lions and tigers and large carnivores are. And so I think right away, most of these animals learn pretty quickly that they're going somewhere. And most of the time they read the people that are moving them and realize that they feel safe.
In late October, all 9 lions were released from their cages into the sanctuary. Their new home is as large as 40 football fields.
So they're actually going to live in a 65-acre habitat and be able to free roam and live as a pride. And so we're looking forward to that. It's a completely natural environment for them.
Odessa Biopark Zoo Director Dmitro Alexandrov says that because of the war, many animals in Ukraine, in zoos and the wild, suffer from constant shelling and lack of electricity, food, and clean water. But for 9 lions from Odessa, their hardships are behind them, and a new and happy life in Colorado awaits. For Alexei Kovalenko, Anna Rice, VOA News.
That'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day at voanews.com and on our social media platforms. Just follow VOA News. On behalf of Steve Miller and the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Karish. Good night.
This is the voice of America, Washington, Z-T-C.